Welcome to Between the Rows, where you get to hear the stories behind the stories in Canada's leading farm publications. Today, Karen Briere of the Western Producer reveals a new strategy to help protect against the threat of prairie grass fires.
Well, this idea came from a Saskatchewan MLA. Before he got into politics, he was an aerial applicator.
Lee Hart of Grain News explains a technological process called tilling that's being used to develop low-gluten wheat and other food ingredients.
Someone is saying, well, if I eat less bread to have less gluten, I just feel better.
And Bruce Burnett discusses how the situation in Venezuela could affect Canadian farmers. That's all on Between the Rows with this week's host, Laura Rantz.
Hello, and welcome to Between the Rows. I'm your host this week, Laura Rantz. Tinder dry conditions have made grass fires a constant threat in many parts of the prairies in the past few years. Historically, fires were once a natural part of the prairie ecosystem, but wildfires sweeping across the landscape in modern times threatens people, kills livestock, and wipes out livelihoods. Getting to them quickly before they have time to spread can be a real challenge for the volunteer fire departments. It seems that they may soon be getting some help from above. Aerial applicators, usually busy helping farmers protecting their crops, have been trained in Saskatchewan to help put out grass fires. The Western Producer's Karen Briere is here to tell us more. Hi, Karen. Welcome to Between the Rows.
Hello.
First of all, how big a problem have grass fires been for people in your part of the prairies lately?
Well, this spring in southern Saskatchewan, there have been several fires that have already damaged property. There was a significant fire in the Lumsden Valley north of Regina that burned through those hills, making it hard to fight and destroying a garage. There was a fire at the Standing Buffalo First Nation that took out five homes, and another in Kanata Valley, which is a resort area along Last Mountain Lake, in which three homes were destroyed. And obviously the cause hasn't been determined, but there were lots of witnesses that said that one was started by sparks from a train.
Okay.
So it's been, it's been dry and a problem.
It's pretty hairy. I mean, why are these fires so hard to contain?
Well, it is very dry. As you know, last year was the driest on record for many parts of southern Saskatchewan. They are fought by volunteer firefighters, which in some cases, can be hard to round people up, and that gives a fire time to move along. And one rural fire chief suggested to me that continuous cropping has actually had an impact, because whereas we used to have a summer fallow that would break a fire that could get maybe a couple of miles at the most, now they just roar on as long as they can.
And we've been getting a lot of wind here in Manitoba. I suspect the same's been happening out west.
Yes, it's been very windy this spring. And I know if you just watch social media, there's lots of concern among farmers about the dry and the wind.
So whose idea was it to enlist aerial applicators?
Well, this idea came from a Saskatchewan Party MLA for Carrot River. His name is Fred Bradshaw, and before he got into politics, he was an aerial applicator for more than 20 years. And he told me that he did fight some fires for the Carrot River Department by putting water in his spray plane and helping them from above, but apparently that was actually illegal.
Oh.
You're supposed to have an operating certificate that proves you've been trained to do this.
But did they feel that that aerial water was making a difference?
Yes, he said it really helps if a stubble fire gets going. You can go along the perimeters and get them in the infancy, and then they just don't spread as fast, and that lets the ground crews attack them more easily.
So it sounds, from your story, I took that they've actually set up a training program for aerial applicators.
They did, and that arose from last fall's devastating fires in the southwest, in which one volunteer firefighter was killed, and at least three others were severely burned. You know, we lost more than 800 head of livestock and bison, and Fred knew that something could be done, and he called on his friend Chip Kemper from Idaho, who operates Queen Bee Air Services and trains firefighters in the States, aerial applicators to fight fires. So they held a course earlier this year during the winter, and they trained 25 applicators to fight fires.
So it's obviously there's some training involved, but in addition to that, what else do they need before they can take to the skies?
Well, they need to have the proper radio system so that they're all on the same wavelength, so to speak. And they had to have the GPS, I guess, is already on the planes, so they know where they're going. The radios need to have the 911 channels so that they're all connected.
Right. So how long or how soon do you think it might be before they have all the pieces in place to make this happen?
Well, the government has said it won't be long. What that means in government speak, I'm not exactly sure. But considering the training was done a couple of months ago and fire season is underway, I'll take them at their word and say it won't be long.
So it seems like a pretty sensible idea. I mean, do you see any evidence that other areas, other regions are showing some interest in doing the same thing?
I haven't heard directly, but I don't see why they wouldn't be. You know, the resource is there. The planes are there. They have the dump doors on the planes, and they can dump, you know, depending on the size of the plane, up to 800 gallons of water. So it would make sense that they could press them into service. But the caveat here is the pilots can't just go out on their own. Mm. They have to be called by the fire department on the ground that's in charge.
Because obviously there's a cost involved here.
There is. In Saskatchewan, it will be borne by the rural municipality that makes the call, or I suppose a community in a worst-case scenario.
Well, thanks very much for telling us about this, Karen.
You're welcome.
That was Karen Breer, who writes for the Western Producer in Regina. This is Between the Rows. I'm your host, Laura Rantz. In a few minutes, we'll be talking to Bruce Burnett, Glacier Farm Media's Director of Weather and Markets Information, about how the situation in Venezuela could affect Canadian farmers. But first, we're going to talk about how a U.S. company is using a process called tilling, T-I-L-L-I-N-G, to develop low-gluten wheat and other new types of food ingredients. Joining me now is Lee Hart, who lives in Calgary and writes for Grain News. Hi, Lee, and thanks for joining us.
Yeah, morning, Laura.
First of all, let's talk about gluten. Low and no gluten foods seem to be all the rage right now. And I'll have you know, Lee, that I had gluten-free bacon this weekend. I kid you not. And guess what? It tasted like bacon.
Well, that's good. Yeah, no, it seems to be a hot topic. I probably a spillover from years ago with the book on wheat belly has probably sensitized a lot of people about gluten and where it fits in their diet. And not being an expert in that area, I mean, I know there's certainly people with allergies and celiac disease, and they have no tolerance for gluten. But I think there's also a number of people, and I can think even in my own family, where someone is saying, "Well, if I eat less bread, to have less gluten, I just feel better." So they're looking for either no or reduced gluten food products, and I think this is where this Arcadia Biosciences is sort of recognizing that, and they're coming along with this. They developed now a reduced gluten wheat variety, and that's about 60 to 70% less gluten than a conventional wheat, and they're hoping that's going to fit the market, a food market for with food processors.
And I guess, I mean, even though it doesn't seem logical if you don't have a gluten allergy to be avoiding gluten, but this company has identified this as a real market opportunity.
Yeah, well, apparently they have. And I think their whole emphasis is to
you know, their effort is to present, you know, health-conscious consumers with some alternatives here. So, you know, and it may be just, I sort of compared it to, you know, some people think brown eggs are better than white eggs, but if you want brown eggs, we'll give you brown eggs. So they're sort of filling that market, I think.
So is this something someone who actually has celiac disease would be able to eat?
No, that, according to the Arcadia guys, they say that, you know, this isn't intended to meet that need at all. Though those people are still, if they have a true allergy or can't handle gluten, they're still going to have a gluten-free. But for people who are looking just to reduce the amount of gluten, they're hoping to come up with some food products, bread products and so forth, bakery products that still have reduced gluten, considerably reduced, but still has a taste and texture of conventional bread products.
So as I understand it, this is a biotechnology company. Are they working with genetically modified organisms?
No, they were sort of clear on that, that they're not in, they're, you know, avoiding processes that would be considered GMO, and particularly I think as they're, like I say, or I said earlier, they're trying to attract this, you know, health conscious consumer. So, you know, whatever person's perception of GMO is, they're trying to avoid, you know, getting into that area. So they're using, you know, new technology, but it's sort of, in their view, it's not a GMO process. It's, you know, sort of using or enhancing, you know, I guess you might say, nature's, you know, natural processes, but maybe speeding it up or, you know, circumventing it in some ways through this process called tilling, as far as, you know, it allows them to select genetic material that is produced the desired results in the crop.
So what does tilling actually stand for?
Well, it's a mouthful here. It's called targeting induced local lesions in genomes. And they're looking for specific mutations in specific genes. And I think it's a mutation that produces a positive result in the sense of it either, you know, it somehow, and I don't understand the process obviously myself, but it's they're looking for some mutation that produces a desired result, and then they're able to select that mutation and incorporate that in the breeding program.
And again, that's different than the gene editing or the CRISPR technology.
Apparently it is. Like I say, it's you know, probably a variation on the theme, but it's apparently this tilling technology has been around since 2000 and has been used in breeding programs, you know, to some extent over the years. But this company has found it effective for producing these desired traits in cereals and other crops.
So as I understand it, I mean, so they're working on the low gluten wheat, but they're also working with starches that, and that might actually have some tangible health benefits for certain individuals. Is that correct?
Yeah. Well, that's the, you know, they sort of have a portfolio of things that they're planning to do. And maybe in some respects, it's, you know, it's designer crops, the sky's the limit here, but yeah, they're starting out with this low gluten, reduced gluten wheat, but another one that's quickly coming along in the pipeline is something that is a wheat variety that has what they call resistant starch, and that starch that is digested more slowly, you know, in the human gut sort of thing. Mm-hmm. So anyway, they're seeing a fit here for diabetics that it reduces these spikes in you know, in their sugar levels and glucose levels, that sort of thing. So it's a you know, obviously a you know, health benefit for you know, anybody who's a diabetic and they want to enjoy you know, a bakery or bread product. Well, this would fit the bill there.
And you also mentioned tomatoes.
Well, yeah, like I say, they've done. Some work with tomatoes and other fruits and vegetables. Again, they're looking at, you know, finding certain genetic mutations that work. And the one thing with tomatoes that they were talking about is they've been able to develop a line of tomatoes that can stay on the vine longer without spoiling. So it matures and ripens on the vine naturally, but it, however, they've manipulated the genetics of this variety, it doesn't spoil. So it gives it a longer vine life and ultimately, hopefully, a longer shelf life when it gets to the store. And apparently, they've also done something similar with lettuce and strawberries and some of the melon varieties as well. So it's sort of amazing the scope they might have with a wide range of crops here.
But I don't suppose it keeps the deer away.
Probably. They haven't found a mutated deer repellent yet, but you never know. That might be something they'll find.
Get them working on it.
Yeah.
So, you know, with regards to the wheats, I mean, I guess the big question would be how soon could it be that Canadian farmers might have the ability or the opportunity to grow some of these varieties?
Yeah, well, I mean, they're sort of, I think their timeline is like, you know, they've, as I understand, they've got, you know, they know they can produce this reduced gluten wheat. They can develop that variety now. So they're sort of hoping over the next 18 months to 2 years to have, you know, seed available on a fairly broad scale, and I forget exactly, but they were looking in, you know, some needs for you know, several millions of tons of 10 to 20 million bushels will be needed over in 2019 roughly. So they're hoping to sort of ramp things up and start producing here. It's a bit of a you know, well, chicken and egg process. They've been able to develop the reduced gluten wheat. Now their negotiations or talks are with food processors, and they're explaining the value or the benefits or the market opportunity for reduced gluten bakery products to these food processors. So then the food processors will hopefully jump on this idea and start producing the product and get them into stores in front of consumers. And then as consumer interest and demand for this product increases, well, then there'll be a greater interest or demand for the, you know, back at the farm level to produce these wheats in a closed loop system.
So, Lee, if they're doing it in a closed loop system, do they have to put it through the registration process?
No, apparently not. It doesn't. You know, not that I'm aware of, and not that we talked about. It's apparently they can. I'm not familiar with the U.S. system that well, or is, you know, so I'm not sure if they develop it in the U.S. Does it need to be have registration in Canada? I'm not sure. That was one area we didn't get into.
Okay. Well, I appreciate you telling us this story. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, no, you're more than welcome. So that's obviously it's a company and it's a technology to watch. What it might be able to produce over, you know, and designer crops over the years to come.
Thanks very much, Lee.
Okay, very good. Thanks, Laura.
Lee Hart is a reporter for Grain News based in Calgary. This is Between the Rows. Next up is Bruce Burnett, Director of Weather and Markets Information for Glacier Farm Media. Hi, Bruce, and welcome to Between the Rows.
Good to be here.
Well, I think the big news is that we did get some rain, at least here in the southern or southeastern prairies, but how widespread was it and how effective was it?
Really, it wasn't all that widespread. And in fact, a lot of places last week got between 5 and 10 millimeters, which quite frankly wasn't enough. Of course, it's beneficial from the point of planting wasn't delayed a lot, so we will be making better progress on the planting side. But in terms of solving our moisture deficit problems that we have in a number of areas, this didn't really go a long way to helping out. Now, it's unfortunate, but any little bit, every little bit counts, but it's just we need more rain than we currently are scheduled to get, at least anyway.
The fact that we got some, does that sort of give us an indication that it might be still in the cycle, or are we still looking very close to being in a drought cycle?
I think we're still in a drought cycle, and certainly with our low subsoil moisture reserves, we're going to need some very consistent rain through the growing season. So this helps because it's one little bit of rain that we've had, but that just makes, you know, 2 weeks down the line, we're going to need some more. So generally speaking, I think as we move into June here, the critical nature of getting widespread rains starts to escalate. And certainly, I think the markets have not been paying as much attention to this as they should be. And by the time we hit June, we'll probably see some market reaction to this.
We've been seeing a lot of traction, I guess, on currencies, and people have been following the Canadian currency. But, you know, when we were talking earlier, you mentioned that these currency fluctuations and the volatility is having some very major impacts in other countries, and some of those are our customers and our competitors.
Yes, certainly. And one of the countries that's been under extreme pressure recently has been the Turkish lira. There's an election coming up with, again, a notable result that you can already predict will be intact. And the president of Turkey is going to win. And after that, he's going to take over the central bank, he says. So that's led to a lot of currency woes in Turkey. Just happens that Turkey is a very important customer of ours, buying pulse crops. And with India dropping out of the picture, this is certainly a market that's needed. And unfortunately, with their currency being downgraded as much as it has, it's making it more expensive for them to import pulses. So that's one thing to look at there. On the other hand, in South America, we're seeing a run on the Argentinian peso again. They've gone to the IMF to try to get some stability there. But certainly between the Brazilian currency, the real, and the Argentinian peso, we've seen both of those drop off significantly compared to the U.S. dollar. That is just making their prospects for good soybean prices next year increase. And in fact, it looks like in Brazil, this currency downgrading has made it the most profitable crop coming up for this coming growing season.
So that means they're just going to be stronger competitors on the export market, or what does that mean?
Most certainly they're going to be stronger competitors, and you would have expected, let's say a couple of months ago, that with increases in the Brazilian prices that they had, but not increases to the farmers, that the area probably would stay the same or maybe even go down a little bit. But right now, it looks as if they're going to plant another 1-2% in area to corn soybeans this year. So that's, again, they're going to be very competitive in the world market with the real as low as it is right now.
So just switching over to Venezuela, which is kind of a special situation all of its own. I mean, the conditions are deteriorating there. What impact does that have for a Canadian farmer?
Well, there's a number of impacts. I was actually in Venezuela about 3.5 years ago, and I only spent 2 days there. But in those 2 days, you pretty well observed that the economy was going downhill and very quickly. And this has just continued. Nicolas Maduro, who actually had just taken office when I was there, is now won an election that was more or less rigged. And so there's some further sanctions on Venezuela. The primary note in Venezuela is its impact on oil prices. Production is about half of what it was just 2-3 years ago, and it's going downhill fast. And with these currency controls that have been placed on Venezuelans, there's really no capital coming into the country. So this is really a dire situation there. It's increasing the oil prices. We can talk about other factors in the world oil market, but the real one is Venezuela. Unfortunately for Western Canadian farmers, this is a double whammy. Not only does that mean that our diesel prices are higher this spring and will probably remain high all the way through harvest this year, but also Venezuela was an important customer. That year I visited, we imported or exported to Venezuela about 1.025 million tons of wheat in Durham. including almost 450,000 tons of durum. So if you think about that compared with now, where we're going to be lucky to export combined wheat and durum of 200,000 tons this year. So it's a major drop off in a market that used to pay very well. And especially for durum, if you think about it, 400,000 tons of durum, and they generally imported between 250 and 500,000 tons of durum a year. It was a very significant market, but it was also outside of what the Mediterranean basin is in terms of our marketing. So it was a bit of a diverse market. Unfortunately, that's gone now. We'll be lucky to do one boat or maybe two boats to them this year.
So that's just stuff that has to find another home.
It's stuff that has to find another home. And especially with the good crop that we're seeing in North Africa now and the Mediterranean basin prospects being pretty good for the upcoming harvest here, it really is a loss of a market that was essential this year. So that's unfortunate. The long-term effects, though, are also in there. This is not a situation in Venezuela that's going to turn around in a year or 2 years. This is going to take 5-10 years for them to repair the damage that's happened to that economy. And it's interesting to see a country like Venezuela, which has the largest proven oil reserves in the world, essentially circling the drain now to go down in the face of $80 oil. So that's a very strange and puzzling thing, but just an indication of how government policies can go off the rails and hurt a country that is one of our most important customers in Latin America.
It kind of makes watching for rain seem more predictable.
Yes, exactly.
Thanks for joining us, Bruce.
Thanks.
That's all we have for you on this week's Between the Rows. But we'll be back again next week with more stories from Glacier Farm Media's network of publications. I'm your host, Laura Rantz.
Between the Rows is a production of Glacier Farm Media, Canada's leading farm publisher. We'd love to hear what you think of the show and invite you to send your comments to btr@farmmedia.com or visit us at membersgetmore.ca and sign up today.